As of July 1st, 2025, applications are open for the Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for spring 2026. Immerse yourself in the Catholic intellectual tradition and experience profound opportunities for spiritual formation in the heart of the Church. Applications close August 15th. Learn more and apply at www.thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. The journey was not too long, and I arrived safely. As was intimated, I don't have much of a Thomistic perspective on artificial intelligence because I'm not much of a Thomist, but I am a theologian, and so I can offer a perspective from within the Christian tradition that is more heavily influenced by Augustine, where my specialty lies in early Christianity. I find myself in the situation of whoever it was, I don't remember who it was, who said, I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have time. So I would have written a shorter talk, but I didn't have time because I tried to make my talk, I saw the title that was purported to be assigned to my talk on the promotional material yesterday. And so I discarded the talk that I had prepared and tried to make a new one that would be about intelligence, actual and artificial. And so I'll begin. And yes, I am a member of the AI Research Group, which is convened by the Dicastery for Culture and Education at the Vatican. And we just got back from a meeting 2 weeks ago in Rome, which was fun. If somebody might close that door. Oh, well, there's one more person. But... No. Oh, wow, you scared him away. That was really funny. You students should be more bold. It's okay to approach a door that's being closed. How are you going to get into heaven? Jesus says, you know, like, it's got to be one guy who, like, slipped in before the door was shut. While I don't want to spend too much time talking about that work, although it is very interesting, there's a group of theologians that meets every 6 weeks by Zoom. We were supposed to meet in person, but then the pandemic came, so we started meeting by Zoom. And that works out really well because you can meet less expensively and more frequently. To converse about matters theological relating to artificial intelligence. And as you may have experienced in the dining hall, when you have people from very different disciplines talking to one another, sometimes it takes a while to get the conversation started. That's why this college, I suppose, has its core curriculum. But we had to invent our own. So for the first year and a half to 2 years of our meetings, we were just trying to understand one another and reading lots of articles and books together until we built up a kind of common shared understanding in which we could begin to think about artificial intelligence. We recently published a book called Encountering Artificial Intelligence. It's on sale on Amazon, not released until October, although I have an advanced copy. And some of my talk is actually drawn from some writing that I did for that book. But of course, in any collaborative effort, one must make compromises, beginning with what you're going to do in the basement with your siblings when you're little, all the way to when you're a professor talking with other theologians at the Vatican. But in this talk, I don't have to make any compromises because it's just me. So now I get to talk about intelligence fully the way I wanted to. So let's begin. Intelligence, actual and artificial, a theological perspective. Ours is an era of wonders. Artificial intelligence answers questions on our phones. It chooses the advertisements we see, recommends our next musical selection, diagnoses brain tumors, generates photorealistic images, paints like Raphael, writes computer code, and offers policy suggestions for governments. With each release of ChatGPT and other so-called large language models or other forms of generative AI, we witness the succeeding introduction, sometimes mere hours later, of derivations that now beckon to us in social media services and even on academic research websites. Contemporary techniques have yielded artificially intelligent tools that in professional interactions, casual conversations, and even if you're willing to pay the subscription fee, casual romantic relationships seem persuasively rational, insightful, and even personal. Small wonder that 2 years ago, Google engineer Blake Lemoine declared his personal opinion that Llama, one of Google's large language models, was indeed conscious. And so we must wonder, what is it that we have made? What is artificial intelligence? What is intelligence at all? In the remainder of this talk, I will pose four questions. First, what is usually meant by intelligence when it is applied to artificial intelligence? Second, what might we have given up when we speak of artificial intelligence as, well, intelligent? Third, what might we say for a Christian view of artificial intelligence? And fourth, why does it matter? So first, what is intelligence actually, and what does it mean to apply it to artificial intelligence? The human being's imaging of God is perhaps most familiar to Western culture under the notion of rationality. Within the Christian theological tradition, Boethius, the 5th century philosopher, looms large, writing that the person is an individual substance of a rational nature. Since the latter half of the 20th century, this definition of the image of God has been criticized as excessively narrow and focused either on propositional reasoning or on domination of the natural world. In other words, reason has come to be associated with a paradigm of control. This, at least, is a theological critique. Christianity's traditional usage, however, was more expansive. It is more recent figures such as Hobbes, Leibniz, and in his later writings, the computer scientist Alan Turing, who have helped to birth the now familiar reasoning of calculation and proposition that vexes Boethius's misreaders today. However, in Boethius, as generally in early and medieval Christianity, humankind's rational nature orients the human person toward understanding, in Latin, intelligentsia. This understanding, or intelligence, is not first a mastery of calculation, but an interiorly experienced cognitive grasp, a hold on some reality beyond oneself as being the thing that it is. Intelligentsia comes from the verb intelligere, to understand, from which we also have intellectus, intellect, or understanding, as a faculty. Intellectus is our capacity not just to remember the visual experience of something, such as an apple, but to remember the apple as an apple. The mid-20th century philosopher, a Thomist, a rare appearance of Thomism in this Thomistic talk, the mid-20th century Thomist philosopher, Joseph Pieper, explained that for the medievals, ratio, or reason, is understanding as the power of discursive logical thought, of searching and of examination, of abstraction, of definition, and drawing conclusions. Reasoning as ratio attains to understanding by way of judgment, and judgments are carried through by this reasoned reflection. However, grounding the ratio is also the intellectus, which Thomist philosopher Joseph Pieper calls the name for the understanding insofar as it is a capacity of simplex intuitus, simple intuition, that simple all-at-once vision to which the truth offers itself like a landscape to the eye. He continues at greater length, the faculty of mind, man's knowledge, is both of these things in one, ratio and intellectus. According to antiquity and the Middle Ages, the mind is simultaneously ratio and intellectus, and the process of knowing is the action of these two together. The mode of discursive thought, that is, you know, reasoning, saying things, moving from one thing to another, is accompanied and impregnated by an effortless awareness, the contemplative vision of the intellectus. which is not active, but passive or rather receptive, the activity of soul in which it conceives that which it sees. To understand, then, this is back to me, not Joseph, to understand, then, is to have a point of view on some facet of reality, a view sharpened by, but not identifiable with, either a course of logical argumentation or a policy of action. This sort of intelligence is an experiential engagement, even a participation in the world. Definitions of reason and intelligence that are commonly applied to AI abandon this interiority in favor of a twofold reduction. First of all, rationality and understanding become the logical manipulation of symbolically represented information. And second, intelligence becomes efficacious problem solving. The foundations of these views did not arise from computer science, but can be traced back to seminal ideas of the early 17th century. Francis Bacon, popularly credited with establishing the modern scientific method, laid the groundwork for a notion of intelligence not as receptive understanding, but as problem solving, with his emphasis on experimental knowledge. Where once philosophy had sought the true and the good in nature, Bacon urged an aim that was thoroughly practical. By vexing and driving nature, he said, we might discover and harness her hidden laws for the relief of man's estate. Bacon represented this pursuit of knowledge for our material welfare as a noble effort to heal the wounds of Adam's fall. Bacon's world was not so much a mechanism as it was an organism. Living nature might be inquired into, but she will also resist, for nature has an integrity and a wholeness of its own that must be respected, even if only for the sake of manipulating it more effectively. So with Bacon, learning the laws of nature so that we might rearrange nature for our good, we stand on the brink between a cooperative respect for nature's possibilities and a plunge into today's confrontational stance that views nature as something to be mastered. René Descartes, in the early 17th century, took that plunge. Whereas Bacon's world was populated by organisms and was even itself a great organism, Descartes acknowledged a life with its own wholeness only in the spiritual soul, which he called the res cogitans, by which he believed human beings were able to think and to reason. Corporeal, bodily nature was simply measurable matter, whether it be a human body, a rock, or a lizard. It was res extensa, lacking any vital force of its own. Particular things were arrangements of smaller components, bound like gears, according to the divinely maintained laws of motion. Therefore, like a watch, the parts of the body and of the greater world could be reconfigured and rearranged to accomplish new arrangements of matter and new causal relationships, new capacities for doing something. The Baconian project of mastering the world for our good could now advance with lighter step, shorn of its metaphysical distinctions, and treating nature as one great mechanism, even more so when Newtonian mechanics replaced Descartes' divine laws of motion with intrinsic mass, force, momentum, gravitation, and all the rest. Bacon and Descartes defined a world to be dominated, but Thomas Hobbes, working in the early 17th century, initiated the journey toward intelligence as a matter of symbolic calculation. Hobbes applied the Cartesian vision of matter to the inner workings of the mind, which became for him a great calculator, suited to the mastery of a mechanistic world. Not that a calculative intelligence was confined to material concerns. In the year of Hobbes' death in 1679, Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz wrote hopefully of an infallible calculus, a comprehensive symbolic logic by which to work out the doctrines most useful for life, that is, he said, of morality and metaphysics. For, Leibniz wrote, reason will be right beyond all doubt only when it is everywhere as clear and as certain as only arithmetic has been until now. In his philosophy of positivism, now we're moving into the 18th and 19th centuries, Auguste Comte, well, he's 19th, not 18th, 19th century. Auguste Comte reinforced the view that intelligence is the practical efficacy of a calculative mind. Comte taught that only empirically observable facts are real, and only empirically verifiable statements are true. Heaven would be created on earth, he believed, by the advance of science, and the human person, as priest of this transformation, was to set technical skill and altruistic sentiment above all else, so as, in the words of Hannah Arendt, no longer to be the wise Homo sapiens, but the maker, Homo faber. The Hobbesian mind was now to be directed entirely to the relief of an estate that could be defined exhaustively in terms of those things which a positive science could alleviate. These voices within the scientific revolution deeply influenced early theories of artificial intelligence. Intelligence in the mid to late 20th century became equated with the logical manipulation of symbolically represented information. Accomplishing this task of manipulating, a properly programmed computer would be thinking. In the resultant enthusiasm for so-called symbolic AI, to diagram a sentence and to construct a plausible response was deemed equivalent to understanding that sentence. Because the AI had not just imitated human output, it had arrived at it in the same way, so thought these early theorists, as humans do. More recently, immense advances in computing power have brought to prominence so-called non-symbolic or statistical AI. Statistical AI often takes the form of artificial neural networks, great computer programs that mathematically simulate an interconnected set of simplified brain neurons. It is these systems that are responsible for the astounding feats of contemporary AI. Now, some might object. While the computer may simulate human thinking, either in its reasoning, its ratiocination, or in its neurological underpinnings, as with symbolic AI, or non-symbolic AI, sorry, still, simulation is not replication. That is, the AI system no more thinks than one's physics homework has gravity or a flight simulator flies. Nevertheless, the philosophical theory of computationalism argues that this is a distinction without a difference. Philosopher Jaegwon Kim explains that for this view, thought is computation. This is drawing deeply on Hobbes, of course. And since, he writes, a computational simulation of a computational process recreates that computational process, for instance, a simulation of addition recreates addition, there is thus no confusion in the claim that a computer simulating a cognitive process is itself engaged in that cognitive process. The reality of thinking, according to this view, is indifferent to the physical substrate that accomplishes the computation, be it a brain or a computer. But computationalism loses something essential from the notion of understanding that is held dear by the Christian tradition. For is the diagramming of a sentence, or the bit-by-bit calculation of a neural network's activation values, really a grasp of reality? Is it true intelligentsia? Computationalism gives us, at best, the ghost of ratio without intellectus, understanding as procedure without a co-penetrating understanding as apprehension. Among other costs, this reduction loses the intrinsic meaningfulness of the operations of thought. Even if a system's internal dynamics and its interaction with the world constrain the plausible range of meanings that might be assigned to it, meaning and understanding cannot be sustained by procedure alone. They require the subject to have a phenomenal, that is, a first-person experiential grasp of meaning. Ratio, in Pieper's sense, is not intrinsically meaningful when it is severed from the apprehensive vision of intellectus. And so, in giving us calculation without experience, computationalism, despite tantalizing parallels between mind and machine, cannot fully describe what the human mind is or accomplishes. Arguments over computationalism, however, are of less moment to the intelligence that is sought by AI researchers today, who tend to focus more on efficacious problem solving. Whether by Hobbesian calculation or not, intelligence must work. It must solve the worldly problems to which it is applied. This version of intelligence has also been part of the field of artificial intelligence since its beginnings. In his 1950 paper, Computing Machinery and Intelligence, Alan Turing famously wrote that if a computer could conversationally express effective reasoning and artistic creativity in a way indistinguishable for humans, then the question, can machines think, would become too meaningless to deserve discussion. I might note that we have reached that point today in terms of the efficacy of artificial intelligence. This test for efficacy, which he called the imitation game, is now known simply as the Turing test. A few years later, when AI pioneer John McCarthy proposed the seminal 1956 Dartmouth Conference on AI, he defined the artificial intelligence problem as that of making a machine behave in ways that would be called intelligent if a human were so behaving. These definitions test the outward accomplishment of a programmed computer. However, if we go further and treat these tests as definitions, then our account of intelligence would edge toward what is called behaviorism. Behaviorism defines an entity only by its tendency to exhibit certain behaviors under certain conditions. As with Turing and McCarthy, the question is not how some behavior comes about, but rather the success of that behavior in fulfilling some external criterion. Behavioristic definitions are agnostic concerning the realities, experiential, metaphysical, spiritual, biological, computational, or otherwise, that underlie the observable behaviors by which an entity is defined. This makes behavioristic definitions useful when we program machines that will interact with the world. Whence, Peter Norvig, a director of research at Google, defines the rational agent as one that, quote, acts so as to achieve the best outcome, end quote. Here, rationality refers not to a behavior's origin, certainly not to its grounding in any experiential intellectus, but only to its success as judged according to some favored empirical measure. Similarly, philosopher John Donahue argues that robots can be called our friends because a friend is deemed a friend when it behaves as we expect friends to behave. It's a very convenient definition of friendship for the one who's defining it. You're my friend if you behave the way I want you to. From this purely exterior perspective, the suitably behaving AI system cannot be excluded from the circle of intelligence, rationality, and even relationality. Indeed, to do so would simply be an act of prejudice. Indeed, Arthur C. Clarke once merrily invoked Turing to argue that those who say computers do not think are mere splitters of non-existent hairs. However, behaviorism falls short, both morally and meaningfully. On the moral side, it permits some rather dark outcomes. In ancient Rome, those who did not or could not behave according to the stipulated standards of their roles within the city would cease to be persons, and they could be excluded from the behaviorally delimited circle of status and worth. That is why unwanted children could be discarded at birth. In our day, we might think also of the disabled, the infirm, and the aged. Although we are ordinarily limited to our observations, when we interact with intelligent or rational beings, the repugnant consequences of a purely behavioral definition of those beings requires no imagination, because we have seen those consequences throughout history. While at first seeming more generous than other definitions, behaviorism in reality returns us to ancient views in which a person's dignity is established by their fulfillment of a social or other role. This persona fails not only to make sense of our care for the immature and the weak, but also even to make sense of the meanings of our words. We think, we speak, we act as if our behavior can bear witness to experiences. One has a caring smile or a delighted grin, makes an angry gesture, or gives a perplexed glance. Our observable behavior implicates our emotional, psychological, and spiritual lives. Any definition that neglects this will fail, likewise, to capture the full reality of our rational and intelligent behavioral displays. Nonetheless, ideas drawn from AI increasingly dominate our understanding of ourselves and of our task in the world. Popular historian and futurist Yuval Noah Harari confidently declares that intelligence is not consciousness. Intelligence is the ability to solve problems. Consciousness is the ability to feel things. End quote. For Harari, the problems that matter are those that are objectively definable and measurable within the material world. Material poverty, climate change, energy production and distribution, political organization, brain chemistry, disease, and the last enemy, death. And these problems are to be resolved by manipulating the material factors that define them. Death is to be resolved in some way, but unhappiness is to be resolved by the manipulation of brain chemistry, poverty by the exchange of goods and services, etc. Harari's intelligence, then, is Turing's. His world is Descartes, absent the spiritual or the divine, and his science is that of Comte. Rationality and intelligence need be nothing more than behavioral ability when the world is a great machine to be mastered. The Christian tradition is not alone in questioning these reductions. Both computationalist and behaviorist approaches to intelligence are targeted by John Searle's famous Chinese Room thought experiment. When I first read the paper, it's called the Chinese Room because Chinese written slips of paper moved in and out of it. When I first read the paper, I was imagining a kind of lacquered wood room with jade doors and a beautiful red desk. And it was really exciting to me. So I wanted to pass that excitement on to you. All right, Searle's famous Chinese Room thought experiment. Searle posited that an AI system may have functional competence, but no true understanding, as may be seen in the case of a physical implementation. If an uncomprehending human being were to sit in a room, preferably one with jade doors, taking input and generating output by consulting a rule book and shifting about bits of paper bearing writings in an unknown language, in the original example, Chinese, where would the understanding be? The understanding would not be in the human functionary who was moving the paper around according to the rule book, nor would there be any understanding in the system as a whole. We, who interpret the input and output and who have designed the system, we may declare that we are observing understanding. The system itself may even be designed so that, interpreted at some level, both its output and its very interior dynamics might echo the pattern of what it represents to us. But even so, a movement of paper slips with squiggles on them still is not about anything intrinsically, apart from any observer. Whatever it is that makes understanding to be understanding is not accounted for by a merely computational or procedural definition. What the system lacks, Searle argues, is intentionality, by which, frustratingly, philosophers of mind mean not the deliberateness of voluntary behavior, but the object-directed quality of mental states. That's what they mean by intentionality, the meaningfulness of my mental states. That a thought is about something, not just through being interpreted by someone else, but through itself. My thoughts are about something. Searle claims that there can be no understanding without intentionality, and that intentionality does not exist without some subjectively phenomenal grasp of something as meaningful. In other words, Searle has rediscovered Pieper's Intellectus. To say that artificially intelligent systems don't understand anything or aren't intelligent is not a judgment of value. It's not an anthropocentric bid to preserve some elusive something by which to reassure ourselves that we are superior to the machines. It must not obscure the achievements of contemporary computer science. Even so, we must be concerned about what may be lost from view if we absolutize parallels into equivalencies. Setting aside whether or not it may be possible for some future AI to be truly subjective, relational, rational, and intelligent, any use of those words to assert parity between what the machines are doing now and what humans are doing must go beyond intelligent-looking behavior. We must go beyond even a structure of processing that seems similar to what happens in our brains or in our discursive reasoning. Any definition of intelligence must include a personal, subjective grasp of reality, an intentional engagement in it. It must transcend the input and output of material reality to subjectively embrace that reality as well. AI outputs that track a course of reasoning are an extraordinary achievement. To say that they are not rational or intelligent as we are is not to say that they are not significant. It is not even to say that they cannot point beyond themselves to certain truths. But there are limits. AI, so long as it lacks interior experience, may have rationally interpretable output and procedures, but these alone do not mean that it is engaged in reasoning. So, we come to my third point. What is a Christian view of intelligence? Talk of interior experience brings me to my proposal, Christian view of intelligence. For the patristic and medieval tradition, and here I have in mind, unfortunately, not Thomas Aquinas, but especially Augustine and his later interpreter, Hugh of St. Victor, the act of understanding, intelligentsia, must go deeper than apprehending and acting upon possibilities for transforming matter and energy from one configuration into another. True understanding, according to these writers, lays hold of the deep meanings of things which they have by their resemblance to God himself. Hugh of St. Victor follows the early Christian tradition in seeing all things as created refractions of God's self-knowledge. That is, if God's knowledge of himself is white light, then created things are the spectrum of wavelengths that arises when that self-knowledge is refracted through the prism of his act of creation. I even bought a set of prisms to try to illustrate this to my children, and I've never actually been able to make them cast rainbows. It's very frustrating. In math textbooks used by young people since probably the 1980s, when color photography became possible on the cover of textbooks, you see little prisms with like lights shining. I don't know where these lights come from. If anybody has one, please show it to me. But the sun doesn't seem to do a good job. I can't do it with a flashlight. And so still, after 5 years of owning these prisms, I've been unable to show my children the meaning of the created world in relation to God's own self-knowledge. Hugh calls created things, the wavelengths, right? The resemblances or simulacra of God. As our words serve to transmit our interior thoughts, these resemblances, the things God has made, are the fragmentary voice of God speaking to human beings. Our intelligentsia is our hearing of this voice. We do this, Augustine explains, by judging changeable things in light of an unchangeable eternal truth that he writes soars above the changeable mind. Intelligentsia does not leave behind the concrete world in order to fly away to divine ideas. Rather, intelligentsia participates in the world. For each thing's resemblance to God is made apparent through its history. To know it, one must coordinate one's own historical life by sensory observation and interior judgments of love with the unfolding revelation of that thing. In plainer language, you learn about a bird by learning its ways. and so its ways must, to some extent, become your own. One must be willing to observe, and one must be willing to love what one sees by seeing it well. So does one's life become an ongoing and deepening encounter with the resemblances of God, and one never quite reaches the bottom of it. This is where Thomist philosopher Joseph Pieper's Intellectus, with its always anterior vision, complements the intensity of our sensory experience. Anchored only in the never-exhausted sensory experience of our shared material world, human understanding of God's resemblances would remain always slightly adrift if we only had sensory experience to rely on. And therefore, for Augustine, the will must judge some particular configuration of goodness that the senses touch in light of the divine goodness shining from above as a wholly unbiased rule. Our judgment of things in light of the goodness of God yields an understanding in the intellect that lodges in and forms our memory. This understanding is no detached observation away from the messiness of sensory experience. Our understandings are an engagement with the world that the senses touch. And even so, our understandings transcend the limitation of this or that resemblance's historical self-presentation. Our understanding, in other words, is not just a kind of collection of all of our observations, but passes through those observations to the deep reality of God's goodness. Both by the coordination of histories, learning to think like a bird in order to watch birds well, and by judgment in light of God, understanding is a participation in reality. By judgment in the active intelligentsia, a number of students have complained to me about their own or their friends' tendency to overthink things. Augustine would say that actually when you're overthinking, you're not really thinking at all. You're not thinking fully, because overthinking is this feeling of like you run yourself in circles and you start to drift away from the reality you're actually trying to, you get farther away from it the more you, well, what about this? And you hedge your bets here, and maybe I should do that or this and that. And Augustine, like Nike, would say, just do it. And then he'll be in greater contact with the reality, and so you will begin to think fully from within life rather than overthinking your way out of life and never quite getting started. By judgment in the active intelligentsia, one positions oneself. You have to take a stance. One positions oneself with respect to the particular good that one has encountered. We encounter something through our senses or the imagination. It is, Augustine writes, veiled by images, but it is not hidden, but revealed as a veil reveals an otherwise invisible reality. Then we judge it as good with respect to something else, ideally the divine goodness, and we cling to that thing with our love. So, in the will's clinging to an object, the intellect has conceived a conceptual understanding, what Augustine calls a mental word. This word is not a spoken word, nor an autonomous abstracted form identical in all minds, but our mental words are particular embraces by our minds of some facet of reality according to its resemblance to God. An embrace, however, that is shaped by our assessment of the thing's goodness. We love something in the things we see, and in that love we beget our understanding, and so we have a deeper understanding the more sensitive we become to that particular thing. Every act of understanding thus entails a moral judgment, and so this word of understanding, this mental word, is conceived in love, Augustine writes, either of the creature or of the creator, that is, of changeable nature or unchangeable truth. For Augustine, in the words of Luigi Gioia, intellectual knowledge is not the result of an infusion in our mind of some pre-existing reality, but rather intellectual knowledge is the production of a new reality in our mind in light both of the world and of the goodness of God. True intelligence is never achieved from a neutral, Archimedean-like point. It is always an engagement with, by a judgment of, the world. Securing this judgment is God's goodness, immediately available to the mind. by a mysterious contact that Augustine sometimes calls illumination. And insofar as we judge things as, insofar as we judge particular things as glories or resemblances of God's illuminating goodness, we know them truly, and our love for them orients us toward God. When we hate some good thing, the thing is still known in that it touches our mind, and by sense images and judgment is impressed on our consciousness, but we can't have a true, authentic mental word concerning some things when our refusal of its goodness renders our apprehension incoherent, blind to how the thing declares God. And so the mind's understanding, its mental words, are truer only as the mind approaches an embrace of some created resemblance as that resemblance is. And this means that one's own desire and love must conform to reality rather than, as a Comtean science might, pluck out from reality only what is congenial to one's own designs. So, inasmuch as our will and our affections, in light of which we judge the goodness of something, are susceptible of reformation, our mind is malleable as well. And so our moral and intellectual shaping of the mind by the way that we live our lives actually shapes our capacity for understanding the things we encounter. And at best, when our love is taken up into love for God, earnestly and diligently practiced so as to reframe and reshape ourselves in light of God, then our understanding becomes a kind of cognitive compassion for or likeness to God's wisdom, which we apprehend from the world in which we participate. But there is more. An intelligentsia that understands the world in relation to God's goodness might suffice for a kind of theistic Platonism of some sort. But for Christianity, the resemblance of God's goodness in the world falls short. The model that the world echoes is not a generic divine goodness. It is God's own interior self-understanding. This understanding simply is the Father's eternal begetting of the Son. In other words, the world that God has given us mysteriously resembles the self-gift by which God himself exists. And so, if we know things through the love that apprehends some goodness, the full measure of meaning the world can be known only through a love that shares in the divine life. Now, no single part of the created world declares the whole meaning of God's self-gift. Individually, God's created words show us facets of his goodness. The meaning of his eternal self-gift is spread throughout the world, and it does not speak openly. Only the created intelligent mind, made in the image of God, and so capable of knowledge in love, exceeds the whole of non-personal creation to be able to refer the regathered goodnesses of the cosmos back to the self-gift of the personal God. As I have said, this is accomplished and the world is understood fully only when our intelligence shares in the life of God. This is the consummation of intelligentsia, fully receiving and passing through God's self-declaration to God himself. There are two stages to this higher intelligentsia, which I cannot expound at length today. First, one recognizes and loves each created thing, not just as good, I like this sugar, but judges it implicitly in light of God's goodness. This sugar is a resemblance somehow, mysteriously and slightly, to God. But even more, explicitly, it is a resemblance to and gift from the personal God. That is why one thanks for the sugar, in addition to noting its particular resemblance to God. Secondly, the human being who has acknowledged the created thing as a gift from God lovingly gives himself or herself to God in an interpersonal embrace. This is where the love begins to encounter God personally. The gift is known fully in our self-return to the giver. In other words, the highest exercise of our intellect, the greatest intelligence, entails a relational encounter with God. At its deepest level, intelligence becomes prayer. Now, I'm going to skip my Christian theology of artificial intelligence to get to the end because I note that it's 4:45. So you'll have to listen to that amazing part by asking me about it when the talk is over. Now, let us ask, why does a Christian view of intelligence really matter? Let's return to our friend Yuval Noah Harari and his claim that intelligence is the ability to solve problems irrespective of awareness, subjectivity, or love, and that these problems are simply those that arise in a world that is a great machine. Despite Harari's confidence, Western culture seems not entirely comfortable with embracing his narrow and lifeless vision of intelligence. Popular culture is saturated by stories that warn against one possible telos of an exclusively problem-solving intelligence, the evil genius, always covetously trying to take over the world. Genius itself does not seem to be the problem. Psychologically oriented takes on the trope from the devil in Milton's Paradise Lost to Gru in the children's movie Despicable Me suggests that great intelligence seeks diabolical domination only as a distorted bid for recognition by and admiration from a creator or parent whose full love one thought oneself denied. However, our theological investigation of intelligentsia suggests an additional explanation for the haunting of the Western imagination by these and other figures, such as Dr. Faustus, Dr. Frankenstein, Tolkien's Sauron, Rogue One's director Krennic, good, and of course, the malevolent Skynet AI from The Terminator. And that is, great intelligence seeks comprehensive engagement. And when Hobbesian intelligence is applied to a comprehensive engagement with the dead mechanism of a Cartesian world, the comprehensive actualization of that intelligence must entail the manipulative mastery of all things. For the Western imagination, when one is alienated from God, as with Milton's devil, or when God has never been, as with director Krennic or Skynet, comprehension easily entails domination. And so, answering both origin stories for the evil genius, the one who was not loved, or the one who seeks comprehensive engagement with the mechanistic world, an Augustinian notion of intelligence as participation in the world and in God honors the particularity of worldly things while directing one's apprehension of these finite goods back to the inexhaustible good that is God himself. It also honors the phenomenal, affective, and moral dimensions of our intelligence, which can never be reduced to detached, discursive reflection alone. Contrarily, an intelligence that can only solve problems in a world that is forever decaying and renewing itself like ours must ultimately turn, as Harari argues, to overcoming transience itself. For any particular intelligence constrained by the material world, the effort to overcome time and decay will lead to a domineering competition for scarce resources. Augustine's intelligence, on the other hand, needn't end in competition because it overcomes transience both by ingenious solutions to material need and by participating in the personal life of an imperishable and self-giving beauty. This full comprehension is simultaneously a loving possession of all things and a state of being possessed or embraced by the one who is love. This spiritual intelligentsia can explain both the exhilaration of the inventor and the silence of the Carthusian monk, and, incipiently combining these two, the young child's hours-long fascination with a water strider's transit across a limpid puddle after a rainstorm. Truly, this is an intelligence that reaches to life itself and its source in the life of the self-giving God. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.